Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Be sure to listen for a special announcement at the close of today's program explaining how you can participate in NBC's University of the Air by joining Roundtable Home Study courses. Now we present Edward H. Levy of the Law School of the University of Chicago. Mr. Levy.
The Roundtable today discusses guilt by association. It is the most difficult problem. It is difficult for everybody. Are you, the listener, guilty through association? Are we, the Roundtable participants, guilty by association? How do we know? Joining in this Roundtable discussion of guilt by association are Nathaniel Nathanson of the Law School of Northwestern University and Malcolm Sharp of the Law School of the University of Chicago. We are all lawyers. Let us begin by giving specific examples of where guilt by association is a principle at work in our society today. Nathanson, have you got an example for us?
Outstanding examples are found in the Government Loyalty Review program. The Attorney General has issued a list of subversive organizations. Membership in one of those organizations apparently creates a prima facie case of guilt or disloyalty. One particular instance that has come to my attention is that of the individual who years ago bought an insurance policy from an organization which now turns up on the Attorney General's list. Is he guilty of disloyalty because of that?
Sharp, how about adding some more examples?
The example that interests me particularly is the discharge of professors at the University of Chicago, University of Washington, lately.
That's a Freudian slip, Sharp.
Two of them were discharged for being communists. One of them was discharged for membership in various communist front organizations. Seems to me an example of guilt by association.
Our surprise example was the evacuation of the Japanese Americans from the West Coast during the war. We didn't have time to try them individually for their individual guilt, so we just took the whole bunch and insisted on their being moved.
The treatment of Furtwängler and Gieseking lately by groups who blamed them and wanted to get them out of the country because they had been more or less associated with Nazis could be described as an example of popular treatment of guilt by association.
And I suppose that the Nuremberg trial, a very popular trial, I guess, furthered the idea of guilt by association. We didn't want to try all the Nazis separately, so Justice Jackson thought that it would be a good idea to try the societies to which they belonged and then label them all as guilty. The tribunal didn't accept the theory proposed by Justice Jackson. Nevertheless, I think that the Nuremberg trial, which I think was a mistake, did further that notion of guilt by association.
Well, now, gentlemen, aren't we really referring to something that we all do, that we've been brought up to do, and that we can't really avoid? We've learned that people are known by the company they keep, the birds of a feather flock together, and things suggested by such adages. That's the way we judge people, and in part at least, and how can we really avoid it?
Of course, it probably goes much deeper than that. You start out, as you know, in history of law, with all sorts of group responsibilities. Families responsible for what its members do. We have vestiges of it today, quarrels between parents resulting from what the children have been up to. All sorts of echoes of that sort of thing.
Well, it's also a wonderful smear technique. It's a good political technique. It's been used by Henry Wallace, I think one of the worst offenders in smearing people as being members of Wall Street.
Committee. It was perhaps a stronger example of how far you can carry the smear technique by connecting any particular individual with an association, connecting that association with another individual, and finally somewhere getting to the point where you have a connection with something with everyone.
Communists are the ones
wrong.
Communists are the ones that have really made it popular. They say all the members of the capitalist class are robbers, wicked. Of course, the capitalists come back and say all working men are wicked. Everyone who hasn't signed a Taft-Hartley affidavit belongs to a union whose leaders haven't signed a Taft-Hartley affidavit is disloyal. We're all full of this sort of thing.
Well, I think we ought to agree that we all do it, but it's bad.
I suppose the most absurd example is the case of racial groups, which without any possible basis of fact are given credit for all sorts of bad qualities of one sort or another. Just because they're not our group, this tendency to put blame on unfamiliar groups is very irrational often.
Well, I think that we have to make some distinctions, don't we, between the groups to which we happen to belong by birth and the groups to which we voluntarily belong.
Such as the neighborhood that we live in, for example?
That may be a hard borderline case.
Fear of the stranger is a guilt by association, as far as I can see.
The attitude toward the Catholic Church, which is a church which people join voluntarily, is an example. The Ku Klux Klan But I myself happen to think that the shooting in Europe, fighting in Europe, really began with the Franco Rebellion. The church hierarchy was behind Franco, but I would hesitate long before saying the church, whatever that means, was behind Franco. And certainly, we would none of us blame individual Catholics, who are friends of ours, for that very tragic event.
Whether they're friends of ours or not, I think the campaign against Al Smith, which kept him from getting the presidency, based on his being a Catholic, was the most pernicious, un-American thing. And I think it brings out the point that the idea of guilt by association is hostile to the notion of democracy, that people are to be judged as individuals, and that there is a kind of relationship between individuals, a relationship of trust and confidence, with those, so that we can work with them in a democracy.
Well, now, Levy, I don't quite understand how you avoid entirely the problem of responsibility for the group to which you choose to belong when that group itself gets into difficulties. For example, you mentioned the Nuremberg trial and suggested that the American position with respect to the associations was there an improper one. But I take it that the tribunal adopted at least in part that position when it found certain organizations guilty and also indicated that voluntary membership in that organization, knowing at least the purposes of the organization, would be a proper basis for guilt. Now, I don't understand whether you're objecting to that or not.
You're talking now about the punishment of whole organizations, not about the punishment of individuals in the Nuremberg case.
I'm talking about both, because I take it that the finding of guilt with respect to the organization flowed the possibility that membership in that organization by the part of an individual might properly lead to conviction of that individual.
Now, I have no objection to the trial of persons for having engaged in a conspiracy, each one of them having committed an act or having authorized someone else to commit an act and knowing what the act is. And I also agree that you can hold a member of an organization if the organization is engaged in efforts which he knows about and which he intends to help. But I think that it's a very dangerous thing to slide from that to anything further. We may have to do it. We may have to come to it. But if we do come to it, it's pretty likely that we can't maintain a democracy. And so I think the presumption is that we should not come to it until we have to.
I wonder whether it wouldn't be helpful, Levy, if you would explain a little more clearly your distinction between a conspiracy, which I take it is a recognized part of Anglo-American law, and what you mean when you speak of guilt by association.
Well, now take the trial of the communist leaders in New York. They're being tried on a charge which says that they conspired to organize this party for the purpose of teaching the overthrow of the government. Each one of them did that, and that is a conspiracy. It doesn't involve guilt by association at all.
That's what the judge said the other day, that this was not a case of guilt by association.
Well, I take it that that trial involves further problems, which to some extent may obscure the problem of guilt by association. These are trials not only for conspiracy, but conspiracy to advocate or teach the overthrow of the government.
No, I think there is another problem. I think you're right, Nathanson. We don't like to try people for the things that they teach. It really goes contrary to the Anglo-American notion that ideas should be free, that countries are strong when ideas are free, when ideas meet the test in the marketplace. We think somehow that we can avoid that problem if we say we're not trying them because of ideas, but for associating. And, of course, we really don't avoid that problem.
In other words, we think of associating as an act rather than an idea. And so we forget to ask ourselves, what are they associating for? And so we avoid the whole problem of freedom of speech, at least in our own minds.
Now, I think the communist trial does raise the question of freedom of speech and the freedom to teach, and I think the legality of the indictment will depend upon the application of the clear and present danger test.
But as far as guilt by association goes, you want to draw one very important distinction between the communist trial in New York, where leaders, organizers, are being tried for what they themselves teach. They may be improper, but it's not because they're associated with other groups or with other individuals that they're being tried, but because they've got together to do something.
Well, yes, there are many distinctions. I'd also say that I distinguish the case of a person who is a member of a society. He's not a leader, he's a member, but he knows what the society is for, and he presumably approves. Well, let's say we know he approves. I distinguish that case from a case where he just happens to be a member and it's ambiguous as to what he thinks. Now, guilt by association tries to avoid trying him separately. It tries to get away from the problem that guilt is personal, which has been a basic notion in Anglo-American jurisprudence. And, of course, we want to get away from it because so many people are terrified.
I want to get clear your distinction between the follower and the leader. Do I understand for you to say that one who follows the leader by joining this association and knowingly supports the association in doing the things which the leaders, you might say, carry on behalf of the association. Can he divorce himself from responsibility if those things are recognized to be wrong?
I think that he can't entirely divorce himself from responsibility, but we've got to be very careful that we emphasize the word that he knew and that he knows what's going on. And it's so easy to go from that to say he should have known what was going on. And finally to say, well, he knew that he was a member, didn't he, even though he didn't know what the organization was about.
Communists, when they speak publicly, always leave it open to you to understand that the revolution that they talk about is a revolution by the ballot, like the revolution which brought in the Democratic Party. And they have been very careful in these recent statements, which have been branded as traitorous, to say they objected only to an aggressive war waged by the United States. They would side with Russia in case the Western powers took the offensive. Made a preventive attack. It's like the kind of objection to the preventive attack that many good people are making, on the surface at least.
Are you suggesting that the doubts, in other words, which arise as to what the Communist Party stands for, doubts, for example, which have been reflected in cases in the Supreme Court, where the court has divided on the question of whether it could be reasonably found on the basis of the particular record before them that the party advocated overthrow of the government, that those doubts might be reflected in the minds of the followers.
No
question. That a person might honestly believe, as perhaps members of the Supreme Court believed, that the party did not actually advocate the overthrow of the government.
Well, I don't think we should forget the clear and present danger test. It's a test which is intended to remind us that the theory of revolution is part and parcel of the American system. It was advocated by the founders of this republic, and that we really do believe in people stressing the right to revolution, at least unless there is a clear and present danger that they may succeed.
Or if I may quote a famous statement that Jefferson made when he came into office, after the unfortunate experiences with the alien and sedition laws, when he said, if there be among us any who wish to dissolve this union or to change its republican form of government, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. If in those infant years of the republic we could afford to take such a position, can't we afford to take it now in all our strength?
Of course, we would all recognize that there's some limits. No state which is worthy of the name will stand and allow its processes to be interfered with by minority groups or any other groups.
That's the clear and present danger test. But the point is that we're not to get panicky, that the presumption is that we'll let them talk. We'll let them talk and we'll let them teach.
Just a handful of people, after all, 100,000 is the highest estimate that anybody makes. Doesn't amount to anything in the national scene.
Now, it seems to me that the Broyles bills are unconstitutional, and they really forget this problem of...
The Broyles bills, these bills that are before the legislature here in Illinois, and they're like bills before legislatures in other states, New York, Maryland, punishing membership in communist organizations and communist front organizations, they're bad on all sorts of grounds. This clear and present danger test is only one.
Well, I think you could revise these bills. That would make them like the Smith Act, which... punishes attempts to overthrow the government, and...
Of course, we've got to act like that, going much further in Illinois.
I think we ought to remember in this connection that the Broyles bills are really, in part, repetitious of the laws that we already have in Illinois, that we have laws which already go further than the Smith Act, laws which cover the whole field of teaching the overthrow of the government by force or violence or other unlawful means. And so that if the Broyles bills are of any significance, it's only insofar as they go into this broad, undefined area of ideas for the reform of our system.
Well, now, look how far they go. The one of the bills would, I think, cause the dismissal of a teacher who just explained such doctrines as communism, anarchism, the theory of a church-controlled state, or the supremacy of the natural law. I don't know whether under that bill you can teach St. Thomas. Another bill makes it a crime to pay dues to an organization, which is called a communist front organization in the bill, and it's defined really as an organization which looks to be quite innocent. The person who pays dues doesn't know that it's a communist front organization. It may be looked to him just like a veterans organization.
The only penalty is provided there, 1 to 5 years in the penitentiary.
Yes, it makes it a felony. Is your point sharp that that isn't enough of a penalty, or what?
I think it's a very considerable penalty for joining an organization of this sort. It also defines as a communist and subjects to this penalty Any person who espouses directly or indirectly or openly or secretly furthers the cause of communism. I suppose anyone who objects to the Cold War or complains about a preventive attack could be described in those terms.
And then finally, one of the bill makes it illegal to be a member of an organization which is trying to replace the free enterprise system in the United States with a communistic economic system, but legally. Now, I would like to be in favor of that bill because I happen to be in favor of the free enterprise system, and I've been fighting for it for a long time. And I think that monopolists probably, without knowing it perhaps, are trying to replace it with a communist economic system. But how can you say that that is to be a crime?
Of course, it's only a crime if you're a member of that kind of organization or at the same time a public officer, I think, under that particular bill. But it's just as bad. I don't think it makes a great deal of difference.
No, that's right. You're perfectly right, Sharp. It's limited to holding office or having employment under the government of the state of Illinois, and that, I think, includes teachers.
I think it does, too, as I read the bill.
Teachers in any institution, irrespective, really, of whether it's a public institution or a private institution, I think.
Of course, there's another bill, another one of this batch of bills, which requires you to take an oath that you're not a member of a communist or a communist front organization, doesn't define communist front organization at all. You're subject to perjury proceedings if you guess wrong as to whether you belong to a communist front organization or not.
I think that this whole problem of the communist front organizations is one of the most interesting and perhaps dangerous ideas which is now current. The communist front organization is assumed to be something bad because it has some relationship to communists, even though we're not sure quite what it is. And so we seem to try to discourage people from, in effect, associating with communists in any form of activity, and perhaps thus directly discourage even the exchange of ideas with communists.
I suppose Truman couldn't hold office in Illinois, could he? He's advocated the nationalization of the steel industry, or at least he's advocated government ownership of some steel plants, and the press has said that was communistic.
Well, I think that's the really insidious thing about the Broyles bills. It's so easy to be in favor of some of the things they seem to have in them. They hit at people we don't like, but it can be so easily extended. And then when it tries to get beyond a narrow definition, which I think it has to if it's going to add anything to the present legislation, it gets unconstitutional. And I think if we could keep our wits about us, we'd say it gets a little silly.
And it's such an old story. We had it after the last war. We had it in the 70s with Granger legislation. Keeps cropping up. And it's just as bad each time, a little worse this time.
The preoccupation with teachers, I think, is rather foolish because I think editorial writers and newspaper men are more important, and I think they ought to be restricted, and I think, really, the heads of corporations are more important also. And I don't know where this kind of thing gets us. We're all going to be taking oaths, we're all going to be registered, and we're all going to be kept from political activity. I think the Broyles bills are against political activity.
Now, you people make these Broyles bills sound so bad that I wonder whether we should be concerned about them at all. If they're so clearly unconstitutional, mightn't we just say, well, even if they're passed, they obviously can't be enforced, so there's no reason for citizens to get excited about what the legislature may do about them.
Of course, I can't imagine a governor like Governor Stevenson signing them. Governor Smith, immediately when he came into office, devoted himself to the repeal of similarly vague and sweeping rules about teacher loyalty in New York and took great pride in signing the bill which finally repealed that legislation in the early 20s.
Well, these bills will be effective even though they're unconstitutional until they're actually tried out. I think if these bills are passed, why, you can't send in a check and you can't have your wife send in a check to any organization which anybody else thinks is liberal.
We might say that we all have an obligation to support the Constitution even before the courts are called upon to support it, that we object, in other words, to the passage of laws which we believe will be held unconstitutional because it is not only for the courts.
I don't think you could even
support the Constitution.
I don't even think that you could send a bill, a check in to a society for the establishment of nursery schools in the state, because many people used to think, at least, that was an idea hatched by the communists.
Well, at the time, when public education was considered socialistic.
And the
TVA and income tax.
Certainly municipal ownership of public utilities.
See what a pyramiding you have here, too. You start with an organization whose leaders and organizers can barely be punished for what they do. Very doubtful whether they can constitutionally under the clear and present danger test for advocating at most the violent overthrow of government. And they don't admit to advocate the violent overthrow. Very grave doubts about the leaders. Then you go down to the members of those organizations who may have all sorts of ideas about what they're in favor of, just as Catholics may have different views about Catholic policy, Catholic polity. Then you get to groups which have the same ideas as other groups, the Communist Front Group, is supposed to have the same ideas as communist groups. And you get members of the communist front group. Mirror opinion at the very worst, vague definitions, everyone at the peril of what a jury or a judge may guess he's done, but jury or a judge may think is right. Sound.
Well, really no good comes out of it from the standpoint of those who are pushing these measures. You don't drive the communists out in the open. What you may do is to have every liberal organization left by the members who are not communist because they're worried about being called communist.
Actually, liberals ought to be encouraged to go into those organizations.
Now, what you say, Levy, suggests another thought to me. I know that there are some people who think that if we could only drive the communists out in the open, as you say, that then our problem would be very largely solved. For example, there is perhaps a suggestion of that in one of the Broyles bills, which requires that any organization which takes an oath of office must register and also file, I think, a list of its members, so then we'll know who they are. Now, there are some very responsible leaders, you might say, who have suggested that that kind of a registration bill would have a useful effect.
Congress fought that out in the Nixon bill a year ago and discarded it on the advice of very conservative folk from New York, as I understand it.
And I thought Governor Dewey had the better of that argument on the political side, but there are legal objections, as you point out, as well.
I think also perhaps the practical objection that was emphasized by Edgar Hoover himself when he said that if there is, or of course, or assuming, you might say, a danger from the Communist Party, the greatest danger was not from members of the party who admitted membership, but from members who concealed their membership. So that this device of registration, perhaps, would succeed in bringing out only the most harmless members of the party.
Well, in short, and to the extent that there is a communist menace, I don't think that these measures are going to help defeat the menace, as much as we would like to have them do it. To the extent that the measures do anything else, I think they're part of a political fight to stop measures that people don't like, to brand organizations with names because we don't like them.
Well, now, there's supposed to be a special problem about teachers, and especially about teachers in public institutions. And as we're teachers, perhaps we ought to say a word about that before we
go. I don't think there's any difference between teachers and preachers, I might say. Ministers, I think, fall in the same
category. How about a teacher in a state institution?
Well, I hope that a teacher in a state institution will be free to teach because I want the state institutions to be strong. That's what's made this country great.
Sam, are you thinking of the particular problem raised at the Washington State University?
Yes, if I found a Chaucer specialist changing his notes on Chaucer on the morning of June 22nd, 1941, when Germany invaded Russia, I might want to fire him for incompetence, dishonesty, and whatnot.
Well, if he teaches cooking, you'd fire him.
Why, certainly.
It's a question of his competence.
The mere fact that he's a member of this Communist Party with its still rather vague aims doesn't seem to me to warrant discharge.
But the suggestion is that membership in the party at least implies the agreement with its beliefs and that one's beliefs may be a test of one's professional competence.
Well, if it really is a test, then you ought to be able to talk about that man's professional competence and you ought to be able to talk about him. You shouldn't avoid talking about him and talk about something else. You ought to be able to say this man is not able to teach Chaucer. Maybe he isn't.
You ought to examine
his ability to teach Chaucer.
In other words, we get back to the point that association is no substitute for a consideration of whether the particular belief really is sufficiently bad to warrant either steps for discharge or steps of prosecution or whatever may be involved.
In 1933, the Illinois legislature passed an act designed to punish the associates of gunmen, like the Capone gang. In holding the act unconstitutional, the Illinois Supreme Court said no legislative body in this country possesses the power to choose associates for citizens. With mere guilty intention, divorced from an overt act or outward manifestation thereof, the law does not concern itself. In 1945, concurring in an opinion that the government had not proved its case for the deportation of Harry Bridges, Mr. Justice Murphy, the Supreme Court of the United States, said, "The doctrine of personal guilt is one of the most fundamental principles of our jurisprudence. It partakes of the very essence of the concept of freedom and due process of law. It prevents the persecution of the innocent for the beliefs and actions of others." Last year, John Lord O'Brien, for many years a Republican leader of the New York Bar and an eminent public servant, wrote an eloquent article in the Harvard Law Review condemning the use of vague guilt-by-association tests for federal employees. He said, "The real danger to our nation lies in these measures to which attention has been drawn, in the mental climate in which they originated, and in the apparent indifference to their real significance. Surely it cannot be said that the suggested restraints will increase the sense of mutual confidence. If there is doubt as to the necessity or efficacy of these restraints and investigations, can we not resolve that doubt by a greater faith on our part in the common sense and the sound moral judgment of the average American? In so doing, we can take for guidance the words in which Mr. Justice Cardozo summarized the wisdom of many generations. Experimentation there may be in many things of deep concern, but not in settling boundaries to thought. For thought, freely communicated is the indispensable condition of intelligent experimentation, the one test of its validity.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss guilt by association with N.L. Nathanson of the Law School of Northwestern University, Edward H. Levy and Malcolm P. Sharp, both of the Law School of the University of Chicago as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes a full text of today's discussion, reading lists, a special article on loyalty tests and guilt by association by John Lord O'Brien, and the American Nuremberg Trial Statement by Justice Jackson. You will want to receive this pamphlet and to study the supplementary materials. Because of the quantity of additional features in the pamphlet, please allow 2.5 weeks for printing and mailing. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. Now, a special announcement.
19 years ago, the University of Chicago pioneered discussion programs in American radio when it began the University of Chicago Roundtable, the first free, unscripted discussion by experts in radio. Today, the Roundtable again pioneers a new adventure combining radio listening and specialized study in its presentation of two Roundtable home study courses, World Politics and Economics in the Modern World. These two courses offer each Roundtable listener a unique opportunity to combine informed radio listening with authoritative reading and study in a program of adult education which you can complete in your own home. These two courses are open to all, and you may begin at any time. Be sure to write today to your local station or the University of Chicago Roundtable for a leaflet. Write for your leaflet today.